For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Let's start with an announcement which came shortly after we recorded last week. The Oklahoma Democratic Party is calling for an investigation of Governor Fallon, saying she interfered with a probe by the Oklahoma Medical Licensure Board of a Tulsa doctor, which was apparently a big donor for then Texas Governor Rick Perry's campaign. Neva, should Governor Fallon be concerned?
I don't think so. I mean, what needs to be concerning is all of the facts and really the information about this that dates back to 2010 when the Medical Licensure Board took this under consideration. And really, I think what we have is a situation all along where the governor said basically, let's decide this. Let's get to the bottom of this. And it's less sinister on the part of these two governors as it's being portrayed, and more about really looking at the serious charges that warranted the investigation in the first place, and the fact that it took 3 years and $600,000, and they still didn't really resolve the issue adequately from the Medical Licensure Board standpoint. And you know, let's inject into the mix the fact that the state Senate, Senator Crane and his committee, had hearings on this back, I believe, two summers ago. There was a lengthy review, and frankly, as I understand it, there were rules that were put in place this year as a result of all of that. So I think there are a lot of questions all across the board, but it's less about trying to just now infuse this partisan political, you know, component to it, and more about really getting, running this thing to ground and getting it resolved where you've got a clear agency and some issues, not only about a doctor in question, but more importantly, I think, about how the entire process went forward from day one.
Ryan.
I think Neva's right. The entire idea that the Medical Licensure Board, which is there to protect all of us, so when we go to a doctor, we can rest assured that that doctor has the qualifications to practice medicine, and that us and our loved ones and our families, that we're seeing people that have been vetted by the state and that have met certain minimum criteria. And that if folks aren't acting within those standards, that they're disciplined and that they're removed from the practice of medicine, so that, as Oklahomans, our healthcare system is populated with people that are professionals and know what they're doing. And so, this entire investigation, the legislative hearings, Representative Moore sat over in the House, a Democrat over in the House, held his own hearing into this investigation. And so there are a lot of problematic things that we've learned about this process. But one of those things is also the involvement of then Texas Governor Rick Perry and Governor Mary Fallon in Oklahoma. And if the governor, and what the governor's office is saying right now is that their intervention in this investigation was limited to saying to the licensure board, you either need to find this doctor or remove this doctor or stop. I mean, you need to do something. And if that's the extent of it, the fact that the governor would weigh in on what the licensure board is doing and their review of somebody's professional qualifications and their credentials and the way they're practicing medicine, that in and of itself should concern us, because the governor is a political figure. Whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, they are a political figure. They are not qualified in any way to weigh in on these investigations. So we need to know how that played out. But I think that Neva's right. There are bigger questions here that are more concerning about the health care of Oklahomans and in the safety that we have whenever we go into the doctor's office, that are probably bigger than that.
Should should she have stayed out of that?
No, I mean, the governor basically said, look, let's wrap up the investigation regardless of the outcome. She wasn't trying to, from all accounts, there's yet to be anyone, I believe, come forward and say that there was some overt attempt to try to sway what was going on one way or the other. It was just fisher cut bait. Let's get to the bottom of this. It's gone on way too long. And I think that is certainly a fair statement by her legal, folks, as well as herself, to make that comment. Because there has to be pressure from someone. I mean, clearly the wheels had come off of this long ago, and I think it's regrettable because all parties were not well served in this. Not the doctor, with the issues in question. The board certainly now under great scrutiny, as well as the overall process and the fact that you had lawmakers involved trying to get to some resolution on it as well.
I think it's worthwhile, though, to know whether or not this is an isolated incident. Did the governor's office intervene on the behalf of other doctors? Were there other investigations that were also going on with the wheels off and out of control, spending $600,000 plus dollars with no conclusion?
And I think if that were true, I'm sure that these folks would have no problem bringing that to light very quickly. So, I mean, I think the fact that we haven't had this upcry and we haven't had all of these people, coming forward would indicate that we are dealing with a relatively isolated situation.
One of the problems that we have in determining that, though, and I think that we'll talk about this in a moment, is transparency, and that the ability for myself or anybody else to know what the governor's office is up to in any particular case is almost impossible with the governor's office's current compliance with the Open Records Act. So, as much as an investigation may seem over the top here, it may be the only way that we would be able to answer some of the questions Oklahomans have.
But I think a governor to say that you have an agency that spent $600,000 on an investigation and still came up with no resolution, I mean, that's a fair question when we're talking about, if nothing else, the dollars that were spent from this particular agency. I see no problem with everyone saying, let's step back and get some real answers to this.
Absolutely, I agree. That's a fair question. If that was the only question, that's one part of the story. If it's not the only question, that's why we would need to dig a little deeper.
Yeah, and you mentioned this. The Governor Fallon is facing a lawsuit from your group, from the ACLU of Oklahoma, on an open records request by an elder advocacy group, Perfect Cause, and the Oklahoma Observer. They filed the open records request more than a year ago, and it's taken that long to get these open records. What's going on there,
Mark? More than a year and a half ago, and some of these records still haven't been released. One of our clients did have some records released to them, and they were responsive to a question that our client never even asked. And so what we're seeing here is this pattern in the governor's office where, whether it's a media outlet or just a John Q. citizen puts in a request, the way the Open Records Act is supposed to work is that it's a very informal request. You don't have to fill out some long legalese document. You can send it an email. It just says, this is what I'm looking for. And most of the time, government agencies should be in a position to respond back, and they might even help you narrow your question to help you get what you're looking for. But with the governor's office, what we've seen is the only way you ever get any sort of a response that's timely. And what the law requires is prompt and reasonable. And so to get something prompt and reasonable, you have to hire lawyers. And frankly, that's unacceptable. The Open Records Act does put a burden on our public officials. I don't argue with that, and I know that it does take time to comply with these things, but to say that it takes more than 18 months, which is what we're at right now, and really in some of these instances, if some requests were made today, our estimates would be that it would be over 2 years before they're complied with, that's simply unreasonable. The entire purpose of the act is that we as the public can have access to how our government is making decisions, how they arrived at the conclusions that they arrived at, and for us to either endorse that politically or to reject that politically. And for us to be able to make these decisions as the public, as the electorate, we have to have timely access to this information. We can't wait until it's politically convenient for somebody to release it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and here's the rub. I mean, we have, in the last 3 years, the governor's office has released, by their number, 357,000 documents to open records, open requests. Their side of the coin, I mean, there are two sides, clearly. I mean, if the governor's office gets a request and it requires 100,000 emails to be released, then someone in the governor's office has to read those 100,000 emails before they're going to, release those or make sure those are the appropriate documents in question to be released. So you have all of these compounding factors. You've got not only in some measure the scope of some of these requests as opposed to a very isolated, as you say. I mean, we would like to see the communication on X date on this specific topic, one or two communications on that. That's a much easier request than something that is going to encompass 50,000 documents or whatever it may entail. So I think you've got that. You've got a governor's office. We, like any of these executive offices, that only have so many folks, that come to work every day in that office. And so there's a lot of work to be spread around. I don't think anyone's disputing, starting with the governor, that there should be transparency and openness in government. What we've got to reconcile and hopefully come to some ability to mediate or come up with with a way to do this more efficiently is how do you get there when you don't have the ability to move it through as swiftly as everyone would like. And so I think to be fair to the overall equation, you have to look at both sides of this. It's not just, you know, I want these documents, I'd like them Friday, and somehow they magically push a button and they just are released. It's much more complex than that, as it should be. I mean, you know, we want transparency and openness, but there has to be some balance to that so that there's just not this continued influx of requests that don't have a normal process and flow to go through to be released.
Well, go ahead, Michael.
No, go ahead.
Well, and you know, we're dealing with this idea of a process, right? And yeah, you know, I don't think that anybody, you know, not our clients, not the ACLU, or anyone that we would represent in this would say that, you know, putting in a request on a Monday and expecting some sort of a return on Friday, if it's, you know, a 40,000 email exchange, that or 40,000 pages or documents, you know, that's not prompt and reasonable. You know, there's that reasonableness requirement in there for a reason, and it's just so that government agencies with their limited staff and their limited resources aren't spending their time complying with these requests instead of doing their job. But at the end of the day, it's hard to imagine how 18,000 or how 18 months is reasonable at all. And let's also, you know, and I get that, you know, the governor's office is dealing in a new age of information. Alex Wentz, their spokesperson, you know, did a very good job earlier this week explaining that unlike other administrations, they are getting more and more requests, and they're turning over more and more documents. You know, part of that, I think, is a very sincere statement of fact. But you know, another part of it is just inflating what the governor's office is doing and responding to these documents. They want to talk about hundreds of thousands of pages are being released. Tens of thousands of these pages are total duplicates. I mean, and some of the responsive documents that our clients received, you had, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of David Blatt's Oklahoma Policy Institute
right. And
daily news blast.
I want to get to that. 50,000 page documents seems like a lot, but a year and a half. I mean, I could sit down and read 50,000 documents in probably about 6 or 7 days. It would take me a while. It would take a lot. But I could do it. Do you think a year and a half is just a little bit too much?
I mean, the length of time is the issue. And I think where do we find a way for them to be able to more efficiently move through the process, handle the demand of these, you know, of these requests, and do them in a shorter time frame? I don't think anyone would argue that. In fact, I'd be surprised that the governor's office, you know, would argue that point as well. I mean, it is just finding the mechanism, the resources, and the personnel to be able to do that. And I think there's the rub, is we have not been able to, you know, be able to marry these two ends, the requests and the ability for the office to accommodate those requests. And it clearly is going to be an ongoing struggle for quite a while.
Speaking of transparency, a new report shows Oklahoma is failing when it comes to transparency. The state is one of 11 given an F, and last year made a D. Now the whole thing changed, so it's not like mm-hmm. we got a D and then dropped to an F. Some of the things changed there. But Neva, are you surprised by these findings giving us an F in transparency?
Well, no. I mean, especially when you look at what they do in terms of identifying and how they really approach this, you know, a grading system and the things that they look at. For instance, you know, the one issue about from the judicial side of finding out which proceedings were included in the public records, which ones were, you know, sealed. The issue that was specifically addressed was the one in Pott County this past summer with Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert, and certainly a high profile enough one that kind of gets everybody's attention and interest, as opposed to just, you know, the ins and outs, nuts and bolts of what we're talking about on transparency and a grading system. But you know, I think when you talk about some of these components, you look at the auditor and inspector, part of that. I mean, they got a much more favorable grade, given that the process is there to allow for citizens to be able to ask for audits, whether it's at the county or municipal level, to be able to have a much more say, much more involvement in the process. So, you know, I think when we look across the nation, I mean, we're seeing in the scoring, you know, very low marks. So, I mean, I think it's a very high threshold that everyone recognizes. Everyone needs to rise up and do a better job. But so, you know, I guess the long and the short, when you're looking at it from a policy standpoint, I think it's going to be a long time before we, you know, see really high marks, but we do need to see improvement.
True, and this is a transparency group. I mean, if I was a group that supported jelly beans and I only got 3 jelly beans when I expected 10, I'm probably going to give it a low score. Is that it, or is there really some serious problems, systemic problems in Oklahoma?
Yeah, I think that there's some systemic problems. If you look at the judge, you know, what the judge said in this Pottawatomie County case, you know, his interest in sealing these records was that he wanted to maintain the decorum at the courthouse.
The quietness at the courthouse.
The quietness at the courthouse.
No paparazzi.
He didn't want paparazzi camped out on the steps. And, you know, I get that. I don't want paparazzi camped out on my stamps, my steps either. I deal with it every day, you know, getting through them, wading through the paparazzi all the time. But, you know, you just deal with that stuff. The idea that somehow trumps the public's right and interest in knowing how their government, including their judiciary, is operating, I think is just absurd. You know, we have as a public not only a right, but a duty to be informed about how our government is operating. And whenever the government throws up roadblocks to make that harder, or we're not complying with laws that already exist or complying with the spirit of those laws, then I think that we as a public aren't able to make the types of informed decisions as a citizenry that we would otherwise be making. And that's, you know, whether it's the governor's office or whether it's some district judge, at the end of the day, in particular with the Open Records Act, the law is the law, and you have to comply with it, whether it's convenient or inconvenient. And if you want to change that, if all of these folks that think that these laws are too burdensome, and that complying with the transparency promises, both in law and many of these folks campaigned on. I mean, you oftentimes will hear on the campaign trail, you know, we need accountability and we need transparency. But then when you get in power, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it's usually a different story, right? You know, as a legislator, I enjoyed the complete immunity from Open Records Act as a legislator.
Right.
And, you know, so I get that. But at the same time, it's something that it is the law. If we saw an effort out of the legislature to try to repeal or amend the Open Records Act in some way, I really think you'd see a lot of opposition to that, not only from your folks in the media that are in the trenches on this issue every day, but I think from the general public. I think that they recognize that having access to that information makes them a better functioning part of our democratic process.
But I think when you look at things like the judicial accountability component, when you have you know, state law that makes it optional for judges to have to explain their rulings, for instance. I mean, you have some things that, you know, clearly when you start factoring those in as part of this number that they come up with for the grading system, I mean, you can see why states like Oklahoma have, you know, have some problems coming up, you know, very high on the scorecard. And maybe there is a reason for some of that to be more seriously looked at.
Right.
I think, you know, just like the financial disclosure for state elected officials as well as for lawmakers. I mean, there's been some discussion about reducing the number of folks that are required annually to have to file these financial disclosures, which, frankly, when you look at them, are fairly top line information. You're not really getting into a great deal of financial disclosure other than having to state whether or not there, you know, you have yourself or family members dealing with states on contracts or some of those issues, which are important to know. And frankly, once again, whether that was in place or not, if you had someone that was openly doing that at a level that was known, it would become an issue, both politically as well as probably legislatively for some change.
Right. And the Open Records, Open Meetings Act was groundbreaking when it passed 30 years ago, 1985, back in Oklahoma. It has since been surpassed by many other states. Should there be a call to maybe fix our Open Records, Open Meetings Act that seems a little bit behind?
Well, I don't know that we need to fix it, but I do think that we need to bring it up to date. I think Alex Wentz in Governor Fallon's office is absolutely right in that the climate of records requests that they're dealing with is fundamentally different than the climate that, you know, say Governor Keating was dealing with, and even Governor Henry to an extent,
sure.
Right? I mean, I think that we see the way that we're able to communicate with our elected officials has evolved so rapidly that it would, I think, be good for the act to contemplate ways that that the citizens can have, you know, faster or more instantaneous access to this information while, you know, still protecting any existing privileges.
But let's also acknowledge that we do have a much broader open government on many levels. I mean, when you look at the internet, you look at the ability that a citizen sitting anywhere in the 77 counties in Oklahoma can pull up and see committee hearings, can see the legislative process ongoing, can pull up and by name look at any state employees' pay, you know, pay scale of what they're paid and what their position is. I mean, there in many ways we have seen a lot more transparency and openness in government, and I think that's the wave of the future to continue to broaden and deepen that. But to say that we're still not making progress, I think is unfair as well, because I think you have a lot of folks that are very very willing and very eager to see, you know, to see progress on the ability to make government truly transparent. And let's face it, I mean, the folks that need to know the information are the people that are at the forefront of, you know, trying to push this dialogue. I mean, the average voter out there it barely can figure out how to make it to the polls, you know, in a general election. So let's don't
Neva
give them too
that.
Much
Not
credit.
Me. Neva said that.
Well, and that's it. Well, let's look at the statistics.
That's,
I mean,
true.
You know, it is the truth. But that's not to say that we don't want openness in government. But we've got to balance this, you know, with looking at where we've been and not just say that that we've not made any improvement at all, because I think it's there.
And I think we have. You know, we do. You can live stream this stuff. It's amazing. I mean, even the difference between when I first went in the legislature in 2004 to today, the transparency and the openness and your ability, you're right, to plug in from any county and see the legislature in action is totally groundbreaking from where we used to be. It's only part of the story, though. And, you know, if everybody's going to get the total part of the story, you know, they also need to know, you know, what lobbyists or what agencies were communicating with lobbyists, what they were saying. What's happening in those emails? What's happening in terms of who's getting money from whom? These are the backroom conversations.
And we can never know everything about everything, but we do know what lobbyists are registered at the Capitol. We do know because they file reports on how they spend their money interacting, you know, buying a dinner, buying a ticket for a lawmaker or an agency director or someone of that nature. So, I mean, we are seeing, it's not just isolated that it's either or, it is, you know, everyone wants more, but realistically what we see is we are seeing more and more, and I think that's the takeaway from this.
But, you know, it's one thing for me as a voter to know that my governor rejected Medicaid because the governor thought that their Medicaid expansion, because they thought that there was, you know, some huge policy pitfall that we were falling into, or if the governor rejected Medicaid expansion because of what she thought it might do to her in an upcoming reelection. I mean, those are things that I think that as a citizen, if we can get that behind the scenes.
And that question came to the forefront, 50,000 emails, as I recall, or something like that, were voluntarily, you know, given, you know, to kind of infuse, you know, that background into the process. So I don't think anyone works in a vacuum. I think anyone that thinks they can do things under the dark of night and get away with things in a sinister fashion are being foolish. But by the same token, the idea that we're going to know everything about everyone and every act and every conversation and every email is also unrealistic.
Yeah, certainly, there are less things that people can get away with in the government than they used to be able to.
Well, we're recognizing, I think, with the current state of open records request, I would imagine that there are probably some informal practices that are happening right now that say, if you have sensitive information, you need to communicate that in person. You need to communicate that in a phone call. You know,
the same that we see in the federal government.
Yeah, things that we're not seeing.
Absolutely. Yeah, so. The same we see with the President of the United States and his cabinet members and other, you know, security-related matters that, yes, I mean, they do that to have those conversations and not start the, you know,
sure.
not start the paper trail.
As much as I'm in favor of transparency, it's naive to think that we'll ever get to a point where, you know, unless government totally, I mean, they act like they're in a reality show sometimes, but unless it really becomes a reality show and they've got the cameras following them around.
Well, when it does that, we'll get even less results and we'll have more absolute vapor lock on the system than we do right now.
A president elected by Twitter. First, I do want to get to this. Governor Fallon has filled the position of labor commissioner following the murder of Mark Costello in August. She tapped Melissa McLaughlin Houston, the chief of staff for Attorney General Scott Pruitt, to head the agency. Ryan, your thoughts on this choice?
You know, I think that Melissa Houston has a lot of experience working in state government. I think that she'll do a fine job as labor commissioner. I have not worked with Melissa, but worked opposite Melissa in many capacities. The very first state legislative campaign that I worked on that won was Bill Nation's reelection campaign in 2000 in Norman, Oklahoma, and he barely defeated the challenge from Melissa. It was then Melissa McLaughlin, but now Melissa McLaughlin Houston in that race. So, you know, I'm very familiar with her. You know, she's incredibly talented, very smart. You know, my only concern would be that she's coming from probably the most partisan elected official's office in the state of Oklahoma right now. Attorney General Scott Pruitt is, you know, I think that there's no secret that he's likely to run for governor in 2018, that he is used his position as Attorney General in a much more partisan fashion than we normally see from that position. And so, you know, I think that her coming as chief of staff from there and going to the Labor Commission, I hope that she'll bring all of the skills and intelligence and expertise that she's been known for and leave the partisanship back in the AG's office.
Neva.
Well, I think, first of all, I applaud the governor because I think it is a great appointment. I mean, she has extensive experience in state agencies, as you say, Ryan. And not only, let's go beyond the fact that she was the Attorney General's chief of staff for 9 years. She was the chief of staff for the Office of Homeland Security. She had in her kind of career path, she'd been the deputy director of the Sheriff's Association. She'd been with the Truth and Policy Advisory Commission. So she knows agencies. She's established herself as an experienced administrator. And I think here's what she brings. Not only the management expertise, she understands the legislative process, and she also understands budgeting. And in the coming year, I think that's going to be very significant looking at this agency, as with all agencies. The other thing I think that we need to kind of lay on the table is the fact that it was also made clear that she would not be running
right
for this position. So I think this sets up for what we've thought all along had been the kind of this ongoing discussion that there will be a push to make this an appointed position, mm-hmm, once again. And I think kind of setting that stage right up front and having someone who has stellar credentials to be the office holder to fill out the remainder of Mark Costello's term is an excellent move. And I think when she gets to the office on December 1st and assumes her duties, that we'll find that was one of the one of the better appointments that Governor Fallon's made during her tenure.
Yeah, wish her luck. You know, I think that you're exactly right. Finding somebody that's qualified, has credentials, and doesn't want the office again after this term, I bet that the number of candidates that the governor could choose from for that is pretty small. I mean, pretty small. So, you know, good luck to Melissa and or Commissioner Houston and on beginning December 1. You know, good luck to her. And I think that the governor's office had a difficult job in finding somebody that met the qualifications and teed up the bigger conversation
right
about making this an appointed position.
And I think it was wise to make that very long, yeah, thoughtful, deliberative decision rather than just, you know, doing it in the moment or, you know, trying to do it without a full vetting and going through this process. So,
and if there had been any sign of cronyism, it might have sullied any kind of talk about
absolutely.
Doing
and I think having someone who has been in government, certainly as opposed to someone who might have come in as a viewed as a political novice as well as someone who'd not really been in government, would have been a pretty big learning curve to kind of jump in and do what clearly appears to be the agenda moving forward.
So what you're saying is Ben Carson was not a candidate for Oklahoma Labor Commissioner.
Probably not.
I don't know. I guess we need to check that out and ask.
I'll submit the open records request. We'll learn about it 18 months from now.
That should be pretty quick.
That would be when the next person's in the White House, whoever
right.
that yeah. is. Yes.
There we go. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.